Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Grandma's Marathon is back in business and in person. We'll hear from the man who was there from the beginning.
I stayed focused on two of my goals. One, I was going to have a safe race for everybody that ran Grandma's Marathon, if you were a 6-hour runner or a 2-hour and 20-minute runner. And second, from day one, was that we're going to have a mini Olympics at Grandma's Marathon every year.
Plus,
Duluth has been way ahead of a lot of other communities in this country.
The nation's most prominent voice for peace and justice praises the Twin Ports on a grim anniversary.
In recognizing the importance of remembering the history of racial inequality that continues to haunt us.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
News and issues from a superior point of view.
Grandma's Marathon is back in business and in person. We'll hear from the man who was there from the beginning.
I stayed focused on two of my goals. One, I was going to have a safe race for everybody that ran Grandma's Marathon, if you were a 6-hour runner or a 2-hour and 20-minute runner. And second, from day one, was that we're going to have a mini Olympics at Grandma's Marathon every year.
Plus,
Duluth has been way ahead of a lot of other communities in this country.
The nation's most prominent voice for peace and justice praises the Twin Ports on a grim anniversary.
In recognizing the importance of remembering the history of racial inequality that continues to haunt us.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. 101 years ago Wednesday, the worst day in Twin Ports history occurred with the lynchings in Duluth of Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee for the false accusation of raping a white woman. 101 usually isn't marked as a notable anniversary, and a major observance planned for last year's centennial had to be scrapped due to the pandemic. Yet one of those activities did continue, postponed to this year, and moved online. That's the speech given last Sunday by Brian Stevenson, the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and the National Lynching Memorial, officially called the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, also in Montgomery. Stevenson's talk is in honor of the three men, and also the many Twin Ports residents who worked to create the Duluth Memorial to them, which stands today as the nation's most prominent monument to a lynching at the site of the crime. Here are excerpts from his talk, introduced by Carl Crawford for the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial Committee.
It is my honor and opportunity to introduce a man who probably doesn't need much introduction, but Brian Stevenson. Brian Stevenson is the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, a human rights organization in Montgomery, Alabama. Mr. Stevenson is a widely acclaimed public interest lawyer who has dedicated his career to helping the poor, the incarcerated, and the condemned. Under his leadership, EJI has won major legal challenges, eliminating excessive and unfair sentencing, exonerating innocent death row prisoners, confronting abuse of the incarcerated and the mentally ill, and in aiding children that are being prosecuted as adults. Mr. Stevenson has initiated a major new anti-poverty, anti-discrimination efforts that challenge inequality in America. He led the creation of two highly acclaimed cultural sites, which opened in 2018. The Legacy Museum and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. Both places we had an opportunity, myself and other members from our community, to visit. If you haven't, I encourage you to do so. Amazing, amazing places. The new National Landmark Institutions chronicle the legacy of slavery, of lynching and racial segregation, and the connection to mass incarceration and contemporary issues of racial bias. Mr. Stevenson's work has won him numerous awards, including 35 honorary doctorates, the MacArthur Foundation Genius Prize, and the ABA Medal, the American Bar Association's highest honor. He is a graduate of the Harvard Law School and the Harvard School of Government, and the author of the award-winning New York Times bestseller, Just Mercy. At this time, please welcome Brian Stevenson into your living room. Hi, Brian.
Hello, hello. It's so great to be with you. Thank you for that very kind and generous introduction. And I'm so honored to have the opportunity to share with all of you in Duluth. I wish I could be there in person. I was looking forward to our gathering that was planned last year on the 100th anniversary of the tragedy surrounding the lynchings of three Black men in Duluth. But the pandemic has required us to shift, and I'm still delighted to be with you. I want to begin by just acknowledging the extraordinary work that has been done in Duluth by community leaders. Duluth has been way ahead of a lot of other communities in this country in recognizing the importance of remembering the history of racial inequality that continues to haunt us. It was over 20 years ago that people began to talk and to organize and plan to reckon with the tragic lynchings of three Black men that took place in 1920 in Duluth. And I cannot say enough to commend the NAACP, the Urban League, community leaders, teachers, historians, academics, activists, who came together to create Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial. It was such an inspiration to see a community trying to do something to make sure future generations understand the legacy that we face. And I just want to express my gratitude to each and every one of you. The Equal Justice Initiative has been thrilled to partner with people in Duluth on the essay contest, which you've heard about, on the marker that has been erected. And we continue to hope to do other things together to make this history live. We remember the way in which bigotry and bias corrupted our community. When we fail to remember, we leave ourselves vulnerable to problems that will continue to manifest themselves. I work in the criminal legal system, and I've seen a manifestation of fear and anger do really destructive things. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. Our prison population was around 300,000 in the 1970s. Today, it's 2.3 million. And for a half century, we've had politicians preaching more police, more prisons, more punishment. We declared this misguided war on drugs. We said that people who are drug addicted and drug dependent are criminals, and we're going to use the criminal legal system to respond to that population. We could have said that people suffering from addiction and dependency have a health problem and we need a healthcare response, but we allowed ourselves to be governed by the politics of fear and anger. And I believe when we allow ourselves to be governed by fear and anger, we tolerate things we shouldn't tolerate. We accept things we should not accept. If you go anywhere in the world where people are being abused and mistreated, where they're being marginalized and excluded, if you ask the oppressors, if you ask the abusers why are they doing what they do? They can give you a narrative of fear and anger. The perpetrators of the lynching in Duluth in 1920, the 10,000 people that gathered in support of that violence had a narrative in their mind, a narrative rooted in anger against these three Black men, fear of not trusting this system. And it was fear and anger that fed the bigotry that allowed this tragedy to take place. We have to understand that we are threatened in a democracy when we give in to fear and anger. I've seen what it's done across the world. It would not have been a Holocaust if there was resistance to fear and anger. There would not have been the genocide in Rwanda if there was resistance to fear and anger. I've seen it in Eastern Europe. I've seen it in Asia. I've seen it in Africa. And I'm seeing it in this country when we allow ourselves to get distant from those who are poor, those who are neglected, those who are abused. When we begin to hear narratives that those people aren't really people, when we begin to accept some of the false ideas that are pervasive in our society, we become vulnerable to the excess, the abuse, the violence that we witnessed in Duluth in 1920. It's one of the reasons why I believe that if we're going to create a just society, we've got to commit, all of us, to getting closer to people who are poor, closer to people who are neglected, closer to people who are excluded and marginalized. We cannot, in Duluth, create a healthy community if we're not looking for ways to get closer to the people who are most marginalized, most excluded, the disfavored, the accused, those coming out of jails and prisons. I actually believe that proximity is key to our capacity to create a healthy community. I believe there's power in proximity. Not only do we have to get close to this history and understand all the details and nuances of where we failed, we have to get close to those who are still struggling, those who are suffering, those who are poor, those who are marginalized. And sometimes we make the mistake of thinking that we can't get proximate to those who struggle and suffer until we have all the answers. And I want to tell you, it doesn't work like that. The answers come in proximity. They come in relationship. We cannot understand what we can do until we are proximate. I just believe that if nothing else, when we get proximate to the excluded, the neglected, the disfavored, those dealing with trauma, those dealing with mental illness, those dealing with bigotry and exclusion, those dealing with food insecurity, those dealing with suffering, at the very least, we can wrap our arms around people and affirm their humanity and their dignity. And some people underestimate that, but I believe that the health of a community begins when we are all willing to affirm the humanity and dignity of every person. The people who struggle, the people who are suffering, the people who are excluded, the people dealing with mental illness, the people who don't have stable homes, the people coming out of jails and prisons. It begins with our commitment to get proximate. I'm the product of someone's choice to get proximate. I grew up in a community, as I said, where Black children couldn't go to the public schools. There were no high schools for Black kids in my county when my dad was a teenager. He couldn't go to high school in our county. And then the lawyers came in and made them open up the public schools. And because lawyers got proximate to poor Black kids like me, I got to go to high school. I got to go to college. I went to law school. I'd never met a Black lawyer before I got, never met a lawyer of any kind until I got to Harvard Law School. But the proximity of those lawyers that came before me made me understand the power of that witness. But proximity is not enough. We are here together. We are talking about what happened in Duluth in 1920 because I am persuaded that the narrative that gave rise to that violence, the history that gave rise to that violence, is not sufficiently understood. We've allowed that history to contaminate the way we think, and I think we have to commit to changing the narrative. You see, we debate issues all the time. We're debating immigration, we're debating climate change, we're debating public safety, we're debating police, we're debating all of these issues. But underneath the debates, the things that people say, there are narratives, and those narratives shape the way we hear things. And some of the narratives that we carry in this country are rooted in a history, an idea of racial inequality, an idea of racial difference. And that narrative of racial difference will block us from doing the things that I believe we have to do. I don't think we're free in the United States. I don't. I think we're burdened by our history of racial injustice. There's a kind of smog in the air, and it doesn't matter whether you live in Duluth in Minnesota, it doesn't matter whether you live in Maine, it doesn't matter whether you live in Alabama or Mississippi or New Mexico or California, wherever you go in this country, there are these contaminants in the air, these toxins that have collected over centuries of bigotry and bias and racism. And a lot of people have argued that at some point these toxins will just dissipate. I don't believe that. I think we're going to have to change the environment. We're going to have to clean the environment. And I believe we can do that if we begin to talk about things that we haven't talked about before. See, I think we have to talk about the fact that we live in a post-genocide society. I think what happened to indigenous people when Europeans came to this continent was a genocide. We killed millions of Native people through famine, through war, through disease. We justified this violence by characterizing indigenous people as savages. It was a narrative of racial difference. We created a constitution that talked about equality and justice for all, but we didn't apply those principles to indigenous people. We ran them off their land. We kept their words. We kept their land, but we didn't allow the people to stay. And we have not reckoned with that history. And because we haven't reckoned with that history, we've acculturated ourselves into accepting these narratives of racial difference. And it was that narrative of racial difference that was cultivated when Europeans encountered indigenous people that gave rise to 2.5 centuries of slavery. And most of us haven't actually learned the true legacy of slavery. Most people don't know that 12 million people were abducted in Africa. They were kidnapped and trafficked across the Atlantic Ocean in horrific conditions of confinement. They don't know about the abuse, the degradation, the violence that Black people were subjected to. When Black people came to this continent, it took less than 20 years before states began making these declarations about what Blackness meant. In Maryland in 1644, the legislature, the governing body, declared that all Black people are subject to labor for life. They even said the offspring of Black people are enslaved. And so before we'd gone very far into the 17th century, you had colonists and settlers and Europeans in this country declaring that Black children could not be born free. And then we created this harsh regime of punishment. The laws allowed enslaved Black people to have their eyes gouged, their tongues cut out. They could be decapitated. They could be assaulted. Black women were assaulted and abused. Black men were tortured and abused. Whippings were common. And this violence against Black people gave rise to a kind of ideology. And I don't think the real evil of American slavery was the involuntary servitude and the forced labor. I think the real evil of American slavery was the narrative we created. We said that Black people aren't as good as white people. Black people are less evolved, less human, less capable, less worthy. And that narrative of racial difference gave rise to an ideology of white supremacy. And we never really acknowledged how established that ideology was. We fought the Civil War, and the North won the Civil War, but the South won the narrative war. That idea of racial hierarchy, that ideology of white supremacy, it persisted after the Civil War. We passed the 13th Amendment, which talks about ending involuntary servitude and forced labor, but says nothing about ending this ideology of white supremacy. And because of that, I don't think slavery really ended in 1865. I think it just evolved. It gave rise to a century of violence against Black people. Black people were pulled out of their homes. They were beaten. They were drowned. They were tortured. They were lynched, sometimes on the courthouse lawn. What happened in Duluth was not unique. It was more north than what we typically saw, but it was inspired by decades of mob violence committed against Black people who were traumatized and terrorized by this violence. Older people of color come up to me sometimes and they say, "Mr. Stevenson, I get angry when I hear somebody on TV talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time in our nation's history." They say to me, "Mr. Stevenson, we grew up worrying about being bombed and lynched and menaced our entire lives." And it provokes them when people don't acknowledge that history of terror. The Black people in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles and Oakland and Boston, Minneapolis, did not come to these communities. And most of them as immigrants looking for new economic opportunities. They came to these communities as refugees and exiles from terror in the American South. And while the risk of mob violence was a little lower, the bigotry was intense. That's why those three men were killed, were brutalized, were tortured in Duluth. And if we don't talk about it, if we don't acknowledge it, we will not repair the damage that was done. You see, that era of lynching gave rise to this consciousness, this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that got assigned to Black people. And even though we had an heroic civil rights movement where courageous Black people did extraordinary things, we haven't really remembered that the right way either. In the 1950s and 60s, Black people were beaten and they were battered and they were bloodied to advocate for the passage of the Voting Rights Law and the Civil Rights Law, but we didn't overcome this presumption of dangerousness and guilt. And I'll be honest, when I hear some people talking about the Civil Rights Movement, it's starting to sound like a three-day carnival. I hear people talking about the Civil Rights Movement, and it just sounds like on day one, Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat on a bus. On day two, Dr. King led a march on Washington. And on day three, we changed the laws and racism was over. And I wish that were the case, but that wasn't the case. That presumption, that narrative of racial difference that got assigned to Black and brown people, it continued. And today, even in Duluth, you can be a teacher, you can be a doctor, you can be an engineer, you can be kind, you can be loving, you can be generous. But if you're Black or Brown, you will go places where you have to navigate a presumption of dangerousness and guilt. Police violence is a powerful issue in the communities of color because it is a lethal manifestation of these presumptions of dangerousness and guilt. And it's overwhelming. And we have to change this narrative. We have to do something to free ourselves from these burdens. And I believe that the way we do that is by talking about our history in a new way. I think we have to commit to an era of truth and justice. The memorial in Duluth is a symbol committed to an era of truth and justice. When I go to Berlin, you can't go 200 meters without seeing markers and stones that have been placed next to the homes of Jewish families. In the city of Berlin, the Holocaust Memorial sits in the center of that city, and cab drivers and hotel operators encourage you to go to the Holocaust Memorial because they are reckoning with their history. I would not go to Germany if they didn't talk about the Holocaust, if there was no acknowledgement, if there was no conversation about the wrongfulness of that era. When you go to Germany, there are no statues honoring Adolf Hitler. There are no Adolf Hitler statues. There are no memorials dedicated to the architects of the Third Reich, the defenders of the Holocaust. It would be unconscionable. But I live in a region of the United States where the landscape is littered with the iconography of those who fought to preserve slavery, those who defended white supremacy. And when you start talking about these things, there's tension and discomfort to even begin to have a conversation, and that has to change. I believe that we need a committed period of time where we talk about the Native genocide that continues to haunt our communities. We're going to have to talk about the legacy of slavery. We're going to have to reckon with this century of racial violence and terrorism represented by lynching. We're going to have to acknowledge the ways in which we facilitated and accommodated racial segregation. We're going to have to contend with these presumptions of dangerousness and guilt. And we have to have the hope and the courage to do this without fear. You see, I don't think we can get where we're trying to go if we're unwilling to acknowledge things that are painful and difficult. That memorial in Duluth, that marker in Duluth, that jar of soil in Duluth, that reckoning with history, some will say is a blight, some will say is a cut, a scar, a mark on the community that indicates injury and hurt. But I say it becomes a medal of honor for those who have worked hard, who have labored to help this community reckon with that past. And the work remains. And that is why I'm so encouraged by all that so many of you are doing to advance justice, to get proximate, to change narratives, to stay hopeful, to do these uncomfortable things. I want you to know I will be cheering for you. I will be celebrating every step you take toward creating the kind of just society we desperately need. We need leadership in this country. And I see a lot of that in Duluth. So thank you for that. Thank you for inviting me to have time with you. And I want to wish each and every one of you all the very, very best.
Those were excerpts from a speech by Brian Stevenson, the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, marking the memory and the memorial in Duluth to Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. We'll be back after this. Grandma's Marathon is back, and so is its legendary race director. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Scott Keenan has just come out with My Journey to Grandma's Marathon, a wonderful read, if I can say surprisingly so, because as a race director, you're not required to show off your literary prowess, detailing, as he puts it, the history and heroes of not just the biggest race in the region, but the largest summer event. That's a far cry from when Keenan and other members of the fledgling running club, the North Shore Striders, got the idea to hold a marathon along the lake from Two Harbors to what was then a run-down industrial district of Duluth Canal Park, and its one bright spot then, Grandma's Restaurant. But I'm getting ahead of the story because he's here to share it with us. Welcome to Simply Superior, Scott Keenan.
Well, thanks for having me, Robin. I'm excited to chat with you.
So you had a budget on the original race, as you have now documented, of $649.51, and I think you said 150 runners in the race. Has it grown since then?
Well, obviously just a little bit. I was never good at trying to keep things at status quo. Starting it, we really wanted to grow it, and 150 runners back then, it was a good turnout. We were hoping to get between 100 and 200 runners in 1977. So to get 150 was good for us. And the biggest marathon, the largest marathon in the upper area, Midwest area, was the Pavel Nurmi Marathon. Mm-hmm. And they had their peak at like 1,100 runners. And I had a goal early on was that someday, somehow, I'm going to be a large, Grandma's Marathon is going to be a larger marathon than Pavel Nurmi Marathon. And we did it in our third year.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back to Grandma's, but I will say of the Pavel Nurmi Marathon, it is still going. So, of course, our listeners in Hurley are quite aware of it. And as with Grandma's, it is again happening this year in August.
That's right. It's one of the oldest marathons in the United States, the Pavel Nurmi Marathon.
Boston's a bit older. I think Boston takes the crown.
Right? Oh, yeah, of course.
Right. I have, of course, you know, this kind of weird, convoluted relationship. I've lived here twice in two different incarnations, separated by a stint in Boston. So I'm sorry that I get you guys all confused. I look up and I say, oh, Dick Beardsley is running. Wait, where am I? But going back to the history is, before you started this, you had a muscular dystrophy marathon along the same route.
Yeah, we did. It was, you know, we didn't have hardly 10 cents in our own bank account, but it was important for us to help out other people. And it started at the Como Scale Gas inside of downtown Two Harbors and finished at Leif Erickson Park. But our goal was to raise money for muscular dystrophy, and we did it. And it probably wasn't a whole bunch, you know, maybe a couple hundred dollars, but it was a good reason to go out and help out muscular dystrophy and get a long run in at the same time. So we knew we had a course, and we pretty much transformed that muscular dystrophy run into a full and a legit marathon. And then we moved the muscular dystrophy race to a 4-mile run. And so we kept that going as well.
Hmm. And as you said, 150 racers for the first Grandma's. This was, I think that was the year, right, that Jim Fix came out with the book Running and pretty much revolutionized running, made it a socially acceptable thing to do.
It was. Starting around 1977, races were popping up all over the country. So it was the right time for us to start a marathon because there was the interest of having it, and we knew that runners would come, which we felt was one of the fastest race courses in the United States and one of the most serious as well.
Mm-hmm. We are speaking with Scott Keenan, the longtime executive director of the Grandma's Marathon from his beginning in 1977 to his retirement in 2013. He's just written a memoir or a race chronicle or something like that?
A little bit of each.
A little of each, right? A lot of each. My Journey to Grandma's Marathon. In your journey to Grandma's Marathon, you describe yourself graduating from Central High School and your parents pretty much celebrating by putting your stuff on the front porch and giving you a strong hint it was time for you to go out on your own. So what did you think you were going to do, and what did you do?
You know, I didn't know I was homeless, but I was. And it was just the thing that I didn't have a whole bunch of money, so I just parked my truck with the topper and slept in that for 2 months or so by Chester Creek in secluded wooded area. And until it got a little too cold for that, then I did rent a cheap hotel room downtown Duluth until I was shipped off to basic training in San Antonio, Texas.
And this was for the Air National Guard?
Right, the Minnesota Air National Guard. It was in Lackland Air Force Base, yes.
Mm-hmm. For people a little younger for the history, that was really during the height of the Vietnam War.
It was, and I had a number, ping pong number of 42, and that was not a good one.
In the draft lottery.
Yeah, in the draft lottery, and so you wanted a 365, and you wouldn't have gone, but 42 wasn't a good one, and that lottery was going to send me to Asia, for sure. But weeks before I would have been drafted, I did get selected to be in the Minnesota Air National Guard out of Duluth here.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't thinking of military as a career. What did you want to be when you grew up at that time?
Well, I certainly wasn't going to be a full-time service person, so I'll just make that clear. I had my 6 years, and then Robin, when they asked me to re-up, I said, no, thank you, and I was moving on. I had no clue. I had no clue at first. I mean, at first I thought I was going to maybe just keep painting. My dad was a painting contractor, painting houses or, you know, apartment buildings or schools or whatever. And it was good money, but I didn't like it. It didn't fulfill what I really wanted to do. So I went to college. Now, my ACT scores were way too low to get in, and I had to work my way to get in and make some deals. But at that time, I was pretty focused on my health. And I wanted to get a bachelor's degree in education under the health field. So that's what I did. I focused that I was going to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm. And you were running at the same time or beginning to run?
Oh, I was running. Yeah, absolutely. And I started running in basic training. I never ran in high school. So
the military has an assistance that you do this.
Robin, we ran a mile at 5 in the morning, and we had to wear combat boots on a 3-inch red sand track. But I was skinny. I was 140 pounds, probably gut looking. And I actually beat everybody at all the runs. And I started realizing that the TIs, the training instructors, were giving me accolades. So the next day I just ran harder. Next day I ran harder. And because I didn't want the TIs to be upset with me. So I was their runner, and that's how I got into running. You know, join the service, you can become a runner.
And again, that led to the North Shore Striders and your volunteer activity with them. Did you luck out? Again, we talked about how running was really taking off then. Did you go on the coattails of Jim Fix and everything, or were you guys contributing to it, or both?
Oh, it was both, definitely. It was more than Jim Fix. You had Frank Shorter in 1972 winning a gold medal in the marathon. That was a big thing. And then we had our good friend Gary Bjorklund, a 1976 10,000 meter Olympian from Duluth, and went to Proctor High School. Things were really picking up, and it wasn't just one thing. Magazines started coming out, books started coming out. One of the best things that happened for us, to be honest with you, was Gary Bjorklund. He was the greatest ambassador, and still is, with Grandma's Marathon. You know, mm-hmm. And he was asked on a national platform. A media platform, what his favorite marathon was. He says, it's Grandma's Marathon. And he says, what else do you want in a marathon? It starts in the middle of the woods. It runs along the beautiful shores of Lake Superior, and it finishes at a pub. And and I tell you, we started getting energy going towards us from that. And also the name. Most marathons were named after cities. And we were named after Grandma's, and what's Grandma's? And nobody knew it was a restaurant. A lot of people thought it was was regarding the cookie, the Grandma's cookie, or some people thought it was just for Grandma's to run the race. So people were talking
and you
about
did
us.
Have a grandma run the race.
Many times. Yeah. And so people were starting to talk about us all over the country. You know, even right now, this is important. Right now, there's no more than 300 people that run in the full marathon with a 30-mile radius of Duluth. From day one, we had to get that feeling out there that Grandma's Marathon was special. and get people from all 50 states and maybe 30 different countries every year. And we were very fortunate to get that message out. Come run grandmas. It's a fast course. We'll treat you right. And you'll have an experience of your lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have one passage in the book referring to exactly what you're talking about. The races draw on for international runners, and some a bit of opposition to it. Some people thinking it should just be the local race or what?
Oh, yeah, just like everything else in life, if you do something, maybe somebody disagrees with you. But I can honestly say that I was focused in two things through my 37 years there. One was put on a safe race for everybody that ran that race, no matter if you're a 6-hour marathon runner or a 2 hours and 10 minute marathoner. And the other thing was we wanted international runners to come to this race. And it was very important for us to have a mini Olympics here in Duluth to showcase our race, our city, to the world. Mm-hmm. So those were the two goals that I never flinched from in my 37 years.
You know, as I asked that question, it occurred to me that's, can I say, stereotypical Duluth thinking, oh, we have a beautiful area, it's wonderful. Oh, why would anybody want to come here? You know, it's that sort of dichotomy that we have, unfortunately.
Right.
And don't think you get away with it, Superior. You're exactly the same way. Again, exactly. We're talking to Scott Keenan, the longtime executive director of Grandma's Marathon, who has just written a wonderful book, My Journey to Grandma's Marathon. You also mentioned that rivalry between two Kenyans in 2002 and 2003. Can I say there's one little criticism? You don't have any pictures of them in what is otherwise a richly illustrated book.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things. At one point, I wasn't even going to put in pictures. You know, it started involving, and I could have gone. Robin, this was...
Well, you could have written 1,000 pages.
I could write
pages,
five more books I could have done. And the early years of Grandma's Marathon, it wasn't about the Kenyans at all. It was about the British people. Mm-hmm. We had Ricky Wilde come on. We had Roy Dooney come here. Our relationship with the English was incredible. And that was an exciting part. That's where we start picking we start getting a lot of... motivation from Europe, mm-hmm, at that time. And I probably could write six more books with more stories and more people, but I'm not going to. This is the book that I did. So
The two Kenyans were Rono and Kamo, I believe.
Right, that's correct. Yep.
Right. One more thing about the evolution of the race is it also coincides neatly, and again, I have to think it contributes to the development of Canal Park in particular. Grandma's Restaurant was the only thing like tourism at the time, and the rest of the area was a good place to find rusty old auto parts, and you mentioned metal springs coming up out of the ground, thankfully not on the race course itself. But the impact was felt later on both sides of the bay and up the shore as well. I can distinctly recall two harbors at the time. In 1986, this was right after reserve mining went out of business. The area was completely depressed. The lights at that time were timed on Highway 61 for you to drive straight through town without stopping. And, well, I don't have to tell you, right? If you go through two harbors today, you never get out of town. The lights make sure you stop and buy something at each street. So Grandma's itself, the restaurant, was pretty much the only commercial thing at the time you started out in Canal Park. And now, of course, just like two harbors, try to get through there, right, on a Saturday afternoon in less than, 20 minutes.
Well, tourism is an interesting thing. I'm definitely pro-tourism, and there's some people that don't like it, and it's too many crowds. They'd just rather have it themselves. But I will say it's not going to go back to the old days where there's no tourism and we got the steel plants polluting the city and the cement plants and so forth. So Grandma's Marathon was an important part of bringing tourists to this area. It was so important. It brought that special events were a key thing, and there was money to be made to a lot of people because of it. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the economic impact was not just City Village, it was more of a regional economic impact. It was partnerships. Grandma's Marathon was built on partnerships, but we had to work our way to get those partnerships. So it wasn't just handed to us on a silver platter.
Right. You also speak of going to the Berkey Binder, which was well established by that time. Particular instance you speak of is stealing their announcer, but well, you didn't steal him. He was able to do double duty, but again, that was part of an influence to you to see, you know, how that was coming along.
Absolutely. I mean, we took pride on learning from other people, and other races have learned from us. Mm-hmm. So it's a very close knit group of people in these race organizations. To go to the Berkey Binder, why not? It was the largest largest ski race in North America, and of course the announcer Peter Graves, his voice was just gravitating to us immediately, and we brought him in around 5 months later to Grandma's Marathon in 1979.
Mm-hmm. Once again, we're speaking with Scott Keenan, the longtime executive director of Grandma's Marathon until his retirement in 2013. We could go on for, you know, you've got about five more books you could write in this. And we could go on for five more hours easily, but we won't. But I will ask you, who are, you know, just some of the names that, other than we said Beardsley, we said Borkland, and of course, everyone knows Duluth's own Kara Goucher. So tell me, who else are the must names and memorable moments for you?
Well, and it's in the book too. And some of the best experiences that we had and memories that I personally had was Jenny Spangler, 1983, from Rockford, Illinois, who ran a world record for the under 20 division at Grandma's Marathon, and nobody knows it. Doug Curtis, who had the world record, it's broken out for sub 220 marathons. Doug, a dear friend of ours at Grandma's Marathon, and one of my favorites, Jane Wenzel, from Boston originally. Her story in the book is called "Miracle at Grandma's," and it's a beautiful story. And Jenny's is a beautiful story too. And Doug, add those on to Garrett Bjorklund, Dick Beardsley. And there's many others. We had so many elite runners from all over the world, and I did put that list in the back of the book of some of our famous people that have come here, and including guest speakers. Frank Shorter's been here, gold medalist's been here. Billy Mills has been here. Joni Benoit has been here many times. So but you know the main thing, Robin, that we did I try to point it out in the book as well, is that, boy, we had fun for 37 years doing this. It was a blast. I loved every minute of it. I couldn't wait to get to work every day. You know, it was something special. It was exciting for me, and I never became that teacher, but I found my niche, and that was promoting the marathon here in Duluth, Minnesota.
All right. We've been speaking with Scott Keenan, the longtime executive director of Grandma's Marathon, who has just written My Journey to Grandma's Marathon, History and Heroes. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Robin. I appreciate giving the offer of time like this for me. I appreciate it very much.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Brooks, is it my imagination, or are there two things in Duluth that I haven't seen for a while? Tours and the lake walk off of Canal Park.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're about to see a lot more of both of those categories. The half-mile section of the lake walk on Canal Park recently reopened with some major changes that will reinforce it against big storms on Lake Superior and provide a, you know, big new walking path and seats and a bike path for folks coming back to the lake. The $16 million project is hopefully going to prevent the kind of damage we saw in October 2017, and then again in April and October 2018. You might remember those storms tore up the boardwalk and pavement, uprooted light poles and rocks, and just swept benches and parts of the trail away. So yeah, the part of the Lake Watkin Canal Park that was fenced off for several months, well, the fences have come down. People are back at it. And of course, with grandmas coming this weekend, it will be a very busy place.
Well, yeah, as everybody hits the lake walk for grandmas and comes back to Duluth, you've got a story about a local boy made good beyond Duluth.
Absolutely. Duluth native Thomas Nides has been picked by President Joe Biden to be the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Now, the Senate still has to confirm this appointment, but it comes at an interesting time in Israel's history. The country has just installed a coalition government to replace outgoing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So Nides was born in Duluth in 1961. He's a Duluth East graduate, and he at one point convinced, you know, then Vice President Walter Mondale to speak at graduation ceremonies. He's a veteran diplomat at this point. At one point, you know, serving as a Deputy Secretary of State, Republican Representative Pete Stauber, who represents Duluth, also said he looks forward to working with him and supporting his choice.
All right. Well, back home and on the Superior side, Danny, there's a change or addition coming to the police department, kind of along the lines of reform that some activists have called for.
Yeah. You know, as we're seeing, you know, more intense scrutiny of law enforcement over their use of force when responding to calls across the nation, Superior Police are adding a position that will work with officers to respond to crisis calls or mental health and substance abuse and calls related to homelessness. And this is something that Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says he's been looking for several years in response to a growing number of mental health related calls. You know, oftentimes when officers go out on these calls, they have to decide whether they're going to arrest someone, do nothing, or encourage a person to seek care. Or in some cases, they have to take an individual against their will to the hospital if they're a danger to themselves or others. And that can tie up resources. And it can also delay the care that people receive. And so they're hoping that by having this new position, which would be a community outreach specialist, they're looking to hire a mental health professional that would be able to bridge the gap and provide services to community members who need it when they're in crisis.
And headed back to the lake, and not the lake walk, but out to Iron County, you've got word of a celebration of the cleanup of Saxon Harbor.
Yeah, and like Brooks mentioned before with the lake walk, you know, these severe storms have really been wreaking havoc on the shorelines of Lake Superior. And 5 years ago, we saw up to 10 inches of rain in just 24 hours dumped across northern Wisconsin, and that sparked flooding that claimed several lives and caused more than $41 million in damage, and Saxon Harbor was one of the areas that was hardest hit. They've had to do just under $15 million worth of repairs to the harbor after the marina and campground there were destroyed when the Oronto Creek basically became a raging river. And so now, after 5 years of work, the harbor is restored with some improvements, which were kind of difficult to get because federal emergency management dollars have some strings attached. In a lot of cases, they can't make improvements to make areas more resilient to the potential for these kinds of storms in the future. They have to build it back the way it was. But they were able to make some changes at the harbor. You know, they repaired a road. They put in a bigger bridge. The boat slip there can accommodate bigger boats than it did before. And so there's been a lot of improvements that they're hoping will be enjoyed by people as they're coming back down to the water. And hopefully avert some of the rains or flooding that we might see in the future, as scientists say that global warming increases the frequency and intensity of these types of rainstorms.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Our theme song was written and performed by Bruce Nelson of South Range, who's been composing a song a day during the pandemic, and he'll be with us next week to share a few. We'll see you then. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view. Gather to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear. By sharing the stories and information you'll enjoy and want to hear. And information you'll enjoy and